Over 30 million children in this country today are served a daily lunch at school through the National School Lunch Program, a federal program first signed into law in 1946 by President Harry Truman, designed to provide low-cost or free school lunch meals to qualified students through subsidies to schools. Perhaps a lesser-known fact is that historically the program was established both as a way to provide food to school-aged children as well as a means to prop up food prices by absorbing farm surpluses. Today, these dual goals continue, with most schools receiving cash reimbursement for each meal served, as well as receiving surplus food in the form of excess food commodities. But given the alarming rate of childhood obesity in this country, the school lunch program has recently drawn some fire. With nearly 25% of American children and adolescents considered obese or overweight, and therefore at risk for developing diabetes, high blood pressure, and cardiac disease, the question has been raised, are these low-cost subsidy and surplus-driven meals contributing to this current epidemic of childhood obesity? Once seen as the safety net for providing nutritious meals to our neediest children, these school lunches with their often high fat content, their processed foods loaded with salt and high fructose corn syrup, are also insufficient of fresh fruits and vegetables. So, as the common aphorism states, is there truly no free lunch? What is the role of these meals in our current obesity epidemic, and what can be done about it? Well, joining us this morning to explore these answers as part of our series on public health today is Dr. Donna Bakke, Associate Professor and Chair of Public Health and Preventative Medicine at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Bakke.
Well, thank you.
And along with Dr. Bakke is her very special guest, Dr. Marion Nessel, Professor of Nutrition and Food Studies and Public Health at New York University and a visiting Professor of Nutritional Sciences at Cornell University. Welcome, Dr.
Nessel. Oh, glad to be here.
Glad to have you both. So, Dr. Nessel, what's really the story behind the so-called free lunches? Are they good for our kids? Or, as some suggested, are they contributing to obesity?
Well, they do a lot of things at once and are very complicated to deal with because of the history that you you did a really good job of recounting that history. The school lunch is designed to provide a nutrient-based standard to children. And the problem with nutrient-based standards as opposed to food-based standards is that it's really easy to construct a meal of junk foods if it has the nutrients in it that you're supposed to be meeting. And over the years, as schools have had less and less money and have had to rely on outside vendors and cost-cutting measures, the school lunches have gotten worse and worse to the point where many schools really just serve junk foods. The kids don't have very much time to eat. It's about the only thing that they can do in the time available. That's kind of one trend. A different trend has been the trend with the competitive foods that you also referred to. They're called competitive foods because they're foods that compete with the school meals. And as a method for raising revenues in the schools have allowed foods to be served a la carte on food carts, in booths, in various ways. And there are rules about what can be served and when they can be served, but those rules are universally not followed. And the kids find it easier to buy junk foods from carts than they do to eat the meals, especially if they don't like the meals.
So in other words, these competitive foods are snack foods and sodas, mm-hmm. and things that would be obviously enticing to kids. Candy. Okay.
Various kinds of candy. There's right. certain candies that are not allowed to be sold and certain things that are not allowed to be sold. And there are rules about when and where they can be sold. But from my experience going to schools, those rules are universally ignored.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, now an enormous movement to try to do something about it to address the really important underlying issue here, which is, are these contributing to kids' obesity rates?
Right.
Well, I think I just want to say one
yeah,
more thing
sure.
about it, and then we can go back and forth on that, just so I don't forget it
sure.
more than anything else, which is the schools set a standard for what it is that kids are supposed to be eating. And the real problem with these foods is that they make junk foods normal. If a school is serving junk foods, then junk foods are what kids are supposed to be eating. And that's where I think the real difficulty comes in.
Yeah, that's interesting. Is that your experience, Dr. Bakke, as
it
well?
It is. It is. Most of what children get in school is junk food, and the food that they should be eating doesn't taste good, so they don't want it. So we really need to look at ways that we can make the healthy food more appealing and get some of the junk food out.
When you mentioned nutrient-based, can you just elaborate on the difference between that, food-based versus nutrient-based?
Sure. One way of approaching school meals would be that every school meal needs to have a certain number of fresh fruits and vegetables, a certain number of grains, a certain number of servings of meat or dairy products or some other protein source. That's a food-based standard. And those have been recommended by the Institute of Medicine in Washington, and a lot of people are taking that approach very, very seriously. The current standard is nutrient-based, that you have to have a maximum of a certain percentage of fat, protein, and carbohydrate. You have to have a certain number of some nutrients that are specified, although never all of them, because there's 50 different nutrients, so it would be difficult to specify that. But it's very easy to put together junk foods that are really terribly processed. I was once given a school meal product that's allowed in the school lunch program that had 51 ingredients. Mm. And believe me, those ingredients were not peas and carrots.
And often things that you can't pronounce, which is also worrisome.
Mostly things that you can't pronounce.
Right, preservatives and the like and all of that. That's very interesting. That's something I think most people really are not aware of. How did that get started, though? I mean, how is it that it was established? The rules were established that it be nutrient-based.
Well, a lot of this started after the Second World War, when there was a big concern about the health of the young men who were being conscripted into the war, and a lot of them showed frank signs of malnutrition. So the school lunch program, which was sort of part of that whole idea, started out, let's use the commodities that the government is buying anyway, and we can put those commodities together into school meals.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. That's very interesting, and I want to come back, but we have to take a short break, and when we return, we'll have Dr. Nessel and Dr. Bakke, and we'll talk more about the inside scoop on school lunches. Please stay with us. I'm Linda Cohen, and this is HealthLink on Air, 570 WSYR. We've been talking about school meals, how healthy they are, and the politics involved in creating their standards. This is HealthLink on Air, and I'm Linda Cohen, along with Dr. Nessel, Dr. Marion Nessel, a professor of nutrition, and Dr. Donna Bakke, our professor of public health here at Upstate Medical University. Well, right before the break, you were talking about how all of this got started with an emphasis on nutrients versus foods. And I was fascinated in that because why don't you elaborate on that a bit more?
Well, when you start designing standards for schools, there are two approaches to do it. You can specify a certain number of servings of different kinds of foods each day, or you can specify nutrient needs that need to be met. And as the recommended dietary allowances, which are standards for nutrient intake, began to be more widely used and accepted, there was a big concern that the schools meet a certain proportion of the day's nutritional needs. Calories weren't so much a problem in those days. Kids were still thin. And so then they were much more worried about meeting nutrient needs that would prevent deficiency diseases. But as the economy in the country got better and nutrition deficiency diseases became less and less of a problem, and chronic diseases came in, then the big concern was over fat and sugar and salt and some of the other nutrients that everybody was worried kids were eating too much of. And so those standards were put in. But these are still nutrient standards. You never talk about food.
And that's a new wrinkle, basically.
Yeah, you never talk about food in this country because these are commodities that very large industries are involved in to a very large financial extent. If you put in your standards that you want kids to only have two servings of meat a day, and they've been having five, the meat industry is going to be really upset about it. If you put in your standards that you don't think the kids should have chocolate milk, you think they should have low-fat milk, the dairy industry is going to be really upset about it.
So actually, you're alluding to something that I know you've written a great deal about, which is basically food politics and the fact that there is an, well, that this whole school lunch, which by the way is no longer just school lunch, it's now school meals because breakfasts are being served in many, many schools throughout the country, that it really has become kind of, or is a political issue. There's kind of conflict of interest there, as you've described.
Well, food is always political. Everything about it is political, from agricultural subsidies to the way foods are marketed to consumers to calorie labeling in fast food restaurants. All of these are issues in which the various stakeholders in the system have very different positions, and those positions get argued out with legislators who have political opinions of their own and whose campaigns are funded by corporate interests and so forth. I mean, food ties into our social and political and economic system in a way that in many ways is easier for people to grasp and to see than climate change or the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, which seem remote. Everybody eats. And so food is a really terrific way, I've found, to talk about some of these issues that otherwise would be out of reach for a lot of people.
Dr. Bakke, I know that you're quite familiar with all of this. And have you seen that there's a major role of the American food industry in terms of helping to define, or their lobbyists for that matter, in terms of helping to define the makeup of school lunches?
Well, they're very active when it comes to policy changes that are done in any of the agencies in Washington, D.C. And so a lot of the decisions that are made are not necessarily, and Marion, you can talk about this too, is not necessarily made based on health, but based on people's interests and who has the most influence. And unfortunately, you know, parents don't always have the loudest voice. And one of the things I guess I wanted to ask you was, what as a parent out there listening to this and concerned about their students' school lunches, is there anything that you parents can do or that people can do that you see that might influence changes and make things more healthy in the schools for children?
Well, parents can act as individuals or they can join groups to affect change. But when my book, Food Politics, came out in 2002, I was approached by somebody who said, you know, I think everything that you wrote about is just exaggerated. I think you made up a lot of this. You're looking at the dark side of it. And I suggested to him that he go to his kid's school and take a look. I mean, I didn't know anything about his kid's school. It was an upper class school district in a rather wealthy neighborhood. And he came back to me later and said, I thought you were exaggerating, but you were understating the problem. He couldn't believe what his kids were eating and were being given in school.
Do you see a consistency of standards throughout the country, though? And I know that the USDA has all of these nutritional guidelines, but I mean, when you go district to district, since most of it in our country is run on the local level, mm-hmm. Do you see a consistency or do you see some disparity
there? No, it's totally inconsistent and totally disparate and entirely dependent on the people involved. I mean, this is one of the situations in which policy is really not enough. You have to have trained people on the ground, to put it bluntly, who can cook. If they're going to be doing that, I don't know how many of your listeners saw the Jamie Oliver series on the food revolution, but he wasn't exaggerating. I've been in schools that were just like the ones that he described and worked with, where the foods were appalling and you wouldn't expect anybody to eat it. And again, it's not that kids are going to die on the spot if they eat a bad lunch or don't eat lunch or whatever. That's not really the point. The point is the standard that's set. And the message that is set, that this is an educational institution that is teaching children, and what we are teaching children is that food doesn't matter. We don't care what they eat. We don't care if they have sodas all day long. We don't care if the only food available in the school is potato chips. We think that's okay. I think that's the wrong message to be giving kids. I've been in schools that have converted their And I've been in some schools in some of the poorest districts in New York City, for example. Really the poorest neighborhoods where the food was delicious. You walk into the cafeteria, you're knocked over by how good it smells. The people who are doing the cooking know the names of all of the kids. A very key point, by the way. I can go into a school, and if the school food service people know the names of the kids, I know the food will be good and the kids will be eating it. And I said to the people who were taking me around, "What is this? What is this place? How did this happen?" And they said, "Let's introduce you to the principal." And I met the principal, and I understood exactly how it happened. This was a woman who said, "I think that what we feed our children is the most important thing in the world, and I can do this, and
so I'm leadership, going to do this." There can be leadership, along with what Dr. Bakke mentioned, that on a local level there can be grassroots opposition and you know, some movement
Absolutely.
To make a change.
Absolutely. You only need, you need a school food service director, a principal, and at least a few other people, parents or teachers, who are interested in this. It can happen. I've seen it happen in many, many places throughout the country. And you go into a school like this, and the kids are eating adult food, and, you know, they've got the same 20 minutes for lunch. The food is good. You know, they may be bored with the menu, but that's too bad.
But they're also developing, as you point out, as both of you have pointed out, they're developing habits that hopefully will carry into adulthood and maybe forestall a lot of the diseases that, you know, are rampant in the adult population.
Well, even more, we'll teach them some appreciation for the delicious pleasure of food.
Well said.
And how good food tastes and how much fun it is to try different kinds of foods.
Now, you alluded to earlier in the interview about the Institute for Medicine, and I know the committee that was formed, I think it was at the USDA's
FDA, I think.
Was it FDA?
Or maybe it was USDA.
In any case, it was formed. The committee was formed to try to make recommendations to improve the current set of circumstances, and you alluded to it. Are you familiar with some of the, you must be familiar with what the outcomes were?
Oh, there's no outcome yet. The report is out. Right now it's in report limbo. Whether it will go to report heaven and never be seen again, I don't really know. But certainly the idea that the committee recommended food-based standards, I thought was something that will be taken very, very seriously, particularly because Mrs. Obama has taken on as her particular goal as First Lady to do something about school lunches and about access to food in inner cities. And there's leadership.
Yeah, that clearly is leadership from the highest level. But they also made recommendations on calorie content and the fact that whole grains, certain prerequisites as being essential components of a school lunch.
Yeah,
right?
And made recommendations about sugars. One of the recommendations they didn't make, which I was kind of amused by, was they kind of let the chocolate milk issue go by without commenting on it. But a lot of the recommendations would make a very big difference in the way school lunches are produced, but they have to be cooked. If they're going to be good, they have to be cooked.
Yeah, they can't just be taken out of a freezer and put in the microwave, right?
Not very easily, and yeah. I've seen that done. I once went to a school breakfast in New York where they just threw a couple of pieces of French toast plastic-wrapped French toast into a microwave and threw it on a tray and handed it to the kids.
That's frightening.
It was appalling.
Well, we have so much more to talk about. We're going to take another short break, so please stay with us. Dr. Bakke and Dr. Nessel will be back with us after the break. And stay right there. This is Linda Cohen. This is HealthLink on Air, 570 WSYR.